Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, presented by great listeners who voluntarily subscribe. Ira Scott, Wendy Bloom, John DeVries, and our own Hearst, not William Randolph, Gillian G. Hearst. My thanks to you. If you're able and so inclined, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Click on the links on the right-hand side. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. In the second half of this podcast, Robert Perry reports on a terrorist tried in an American court on American soil. Of course, he's a Cuban and a CIA asset for a long time, so the rules do not apply. On the day after he was sworn in as president, Barack Obama, with a flourish, signed a presidential order saying that Guantanamo Bay's prison camp in Cuba should be closed within 1 year. And 2 years later, he's acknowledged that that promise will not be kept. And so far, he's paying very little political price for it. There's barely been a peep from progressives, from Democrats, from Republicans. The status quo of Gitmo seems to be okay with way too many Americans. I want to welcome Andy Worthington back to our program today, the British journalist who has been doing incredible work, and it shows up the American media in so many respects. Andy is the author of The Guantanamo Files, producer and presenter on the documentary Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo, and he blogs prolifically, posting original reporting on a regular basis at the website andyworthington.co.uk. Andy, great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you as well, Peter. Good to be back.
And we've been pulling for you. Andy was in the hospital with some medical complications, and it didn't cost him anything under the British health system, but it did lay him up for a couple of weeks, and as a result, you have been writing almost every day, Andy, so your loss has been... to some extent, our gain.
Well, in some ways, I think I probably was working as hard before. I don't know whether it's. I decided actually that I'm going to. I was trying to calm down a little bit, so I work a lot, but I'm trying to work more steadily and make sure there's something new up on my site every day. That's really what I'm aiming for now. One thing a day, something mm-hmm. that's worth reading there every day that people can come to.
And before we dive into some of your recent articles, I read your work occasionally. I come by the site usually once a week, and you're one of my Facebook friends, so I see when you post a new story. I try to keep abreast of what you're doing. And recently, you've gotten a little bit frustrated and maybe dispirited about the way things are really closing in on our aspirations for justice for those held at Guantanamo and ultimately closure of that barbaric facility.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think the sad collision of President Obama and his kind of incessant ability to fold under pressure, and the most negative kind of campaigning from the Republican Party that I can recall ever seeing, you know, on national security issues. The result of that has just been, you know, thoroughly depressing, Peter. I mean, you know, the fact that we have ended up in the position that we're in now, where, for example, you know, when Eric Holder backed down, you know, just last week on the proposed federal court trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the 9/11 co-conspirators, you know, purely because of political pressure, that it was you know, it was impossible really to go ahead with the federal court trial. You know, Republicans had inserted a provision into the colossal defense spending bill before Christmas saying, you know, no Guantanamo prisoner is to be brought to the U.S. mainland to face a trial under any circumstances. They mentioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed by name. And when you know, this went through and the indictment that had been filed in New York was unsealed, you know, here we are looking at, you know, at the 14th indictment in a series that goes back to 1993, to Ramzi Youssef, the man who tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993,
right.
Whose uncle is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. 14 indictments. The last one was the one that was unsealed, you know, last week, because essentially it was thrown away because of the pressure from the Republicans and, again, to a certain extent, Obama's refusal to stand up to criticism means that what from 1993 onwards was you know, a very serious series of cases that were tried successfully in federal court, the build-up of these indictments that have followed on, suddenly it's derailed. Suddenly it becomes inappropriate for these men to be tried in federal court, and they must only be tried in a military tribunal at Guantanamo, a military commission. They have to be warriors, because the war on terror is what it's about. And, you know, these people used to be criminals. These people fundamentally still are criminals. But the people who won are George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, the people who invented the war on terror and threw away all our laws and our treaties and our notions of how you treat people when you capture them and accuse them of wrongdoing. And they're winning. I mean, from beyond the political grave, they are winning. And it's very, very depressing indeed.
And Andy, I just want to add one element here about the domestic opposition to Obama on Guantanamo and federal trials in American courts on American soil for those detained at Guantanamo. And that is, the ugly truth is that many Democrats are as complicit as the Republicans you cite. It's true that the defense appropriation rider that included the exclusion for any funding to bring anybody from Guantanamo to the United States and that named KSM was written by Republicans. But it is staunchly supported by Democratic leaders right up to Senate Leader Harry Reid. And I to refresh my memory, I went to YouTube last week and I watched a clip of Harry Reid in 2009 flatly saying that no Guantanamo detainee should ever come to the United States, whether they've been cleared as innocent of terrorism charges or they're coming to be tried or to be sentenced to a term in a supermax federal prison. And he was as uncompromising and jingoistic about it as any Republican who I've heard. And it's another one of the very discouraging factors for me as a progressive American who wants to see us return to constitutional rule, who wants to see us return to the confines of the treaties that we helped initiate and that were signatories to, the Geneva Conventions. And so this whole detour from justice and fidelity to the law is embraced on a broad scale in the United States, and it's something that's very hard for me to accept.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think the entire landscape has changed drastically, you know, and you know, the fact that Guantanamo has actually been a barometer for how America behaves ever since it opened, to see what's happening now, to see how much worse it is now than it was, for example, I think, in the last couple of years of the Bush administration, is a sign of something deeply troubling going on. And, you know, when you add to that the fact that almost nobody cares anymore, that's what I find truly disturbing. And it makes me wonder, well, how is it possible for this to be raised as an important issue for the American people again?
Well, Andy, here's a bizarre episode that it just occurred this week. The leader of a pro-Catholic organization, it's a lay group, it's not directly connected to the church hierarchy, they bought a full-page ad in the New York Times, and they're decrying the way people view priests and bishops who either participated in or covered up the pedophile behavior that has been an epidemic in the United States and now we know worldwide.
Yeah.
And this guy, O'Donohue, who's a very conservative Catholic, made the case, or tried to, that the whiny people who care about those who are held at Guantanamo don't care as much about priests who are being, in his view, falsely tarnished with the taint of this sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. And it just shows, here's a guy who postures as moral and righteous, and you know, he's trying to speak up for the best interests of the Catholic Church, and the comparison he uses is at the expense of people, many innocent, who remain held without charge indefinitely at Guantanamo.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think... You know, it just seems that they've become so much more part of a kind of very unpleasant and generally acceptable discourse than they were under Bush. When I think that the thing that under Bush was that that apart from in the early years where everybody was so caught up in the fervor of having to be seen to respond adequately to the 9/11 attacks, as soon as people started questioning it, I think that it was constantly questioned. But those last few years of Bush's administration, in some ways since the from the time when the Abu Ghraib photos came out in April 2004, I think, you know, you can see, if you actually look at events that happened from then, how it was constantly being challenged, being questioned, and that all of that has gone, and we have now this kind of parody of, you know, of Guantanamo, and we have, you know, we have the kind of bullishness about torture, and you know, the American Red Cross has come up with something this week pointing out that, you know, that a majority of young Americans think that torture is unacceptable, think that torture is acceptable. You know, they've bought into this whole horrible new American psychic landscape. And it's the fact that it's become such a fixture, and that it can be referred to now as though it's somehow that's acceptable. That what's missing from that is a voice piping up and saying, you know, you really shouldn't be making jokes about this. This is still as unacceptable as it always has been. That this is still the project that the Bush administration initiated, which, you know, turned America into a lawless, arrogant place with disdain for international norms, with disdain for the Convention Against Torture. That's where we've ended up.
And the corporate media in this country keeps us oblivious to these issues because, A, they don't provide reporting from perspectives outside the United States on any regular basis, and because they fail in their duty to investigate and report on these issues. We get very little broadcast coverage. Even there was a brief blip about Holder's decision not to hold the trials in the United States, but very little about what you and I are about to discuss, in which you expertly wrapped up in an article called How the Supreme Court Gave Up on Guantanamo, and I'll link to that. I'll link to that in the show file at peterbcollins.com. But, for example, the discussion about the relationship between the D.C. Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court is something that even the court writers, the people who cover that as a beat, I have not seen surface on the web or in broadcast.
Right. And, I don't think it ever makes it into broadcast, Peter. You know, Scottish vlog is always very good. You know, there are, if you're lucky, every time that there's a story out of the DC Circuit Court or the District Courts on habeas, then, you know, maybe one or two of the major newspapers will mention it. It's barely there. I mean, it really is barely there. What has happened that, you know, that discussions about the legal proceedings that have come out of the Guantanamo story are almost entirely invisible in the United States. And that it's come down to someone who, well, myself, who's not a Native American, who has, you know, had to try and grapple with, you know, over the years, with understanding the structure of all the legal bodies in the United States and how everything works,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I realized there was something very significant going on here. It distresses me that, you know, that this story that we're going to talk about and that I've just written about has only been mentioned in about four other places in the United States media.
Yeah.
You know, what is going on?
Right. So I think most of my listeners are aware that Eric Holder threw in the towel and the Obama administration has capitulated both on closing Guantanamo and on their expressed desire to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other alleged conspirators of the 9/11 events in New York City. And so that I think most people know about. What I'd like you to address now is the D.C. Circuit Court's ruling and the Supreme Court's refusal to hear an appeal of habeas corpus cases coming from that very conservative Court of Appeals in Washington.
Sure. Well, you know, what it is basically is that, you know, ever since the habeas litigation really got underway, which was in the fall of 2008, after the Supreme Court, in this famous case, Boumediene v. Bush, you know, confirmed that the Guantanamo prisoners had constitutionally guaranteed habeas corpus rights. They could challenge in a court the basis of their detention. And the cases got underway, and there were a number of, you know, significant successes for the prisoners early on. The first case involved 17 Uyghurs, the Muslims from China's Xinjiang province, who pretty much everybody except certain right-wingers will acknowledge were essentially completely innocent people with no involvement with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, who had been, you know, scratching out a kind of living, some of them with these fantasies of rising up against the Chinese government in some run-down, horribly run-down little place in the Afghan mountains, who had, you know, been forced to run away after they were bombed when the U.S. invaded in October 2001, crossed the border, were seized by Pakistani villagers who welcomed them and then sold them to the Americans. You know, everybody agreed, you know, these guys shouldn't have been held. So they were the first of, you know, many cases that were won by the prisoners, because the district court had to come up with its own analysis of what an enemy combatant was and what the standards of detention were that were required, because the Supreme Court refused to lay down very clear rules about this, you know, which would have been it's a task for anybody to do this, because the problem was the imprecision with which the Bush administration was holding people in the first place. It wasn't clear exactly what an enemy combatant was, and the Bush administration hadn't made it clear either. So anyway, the district court did a great job of working out who should be held and why, you know, and they thoroughly analyzed the material that was available to them and the material that came from the government.
And they essentially crafted a standard that an inmate, a detainee, had to have direct contact with the command structure.
Yes.
Of one of these identified terrorist organizations.
Well, of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I've always had a problem that there's a fundamental confusion in the war on terror between a terrorist group, which is Al-Qaeda,
yeah.
and the Taliban, which was the government, however much it was a reviled government, but which was the government of Afghanistan.
And also an organization that was created by the Pakistani Intelligence Agency,
right.
the ISI. So it's convoluted, I understand.
Yeah, but yes, that's what they had. They crafted that, and it took some time before the government first appealed, and those appeals came up in front of the D.C. Circuit Court, So, you know, this is the appeals court that rules on appeals from the district court, which was making the decisions on these habeas petitions. And since January 2010, a number of judges in that court, and there are, you know, there are kind of four of them in particular, but Judge A. Raymond Randolph is the kind of top of the pile of those, of a man with a, you know, fundamentally a very notoriously right-wing history when it comes to Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
He defended every piece of legislation that was subsequently overturned by the Supreme Court. The great Guantanamo decisions by the Supreme Court giving rights to the prisoners were you know, the Supreme Court was overturning things that were approved by Judge A. Raymond Randolph, who's a senior judge in the D.C. Circuit. But what's been happening since the circuit court got its hands on the appeals cases is they've been whittling away at the standards that it required and essentially saying, no, being part of the command structure is taking things too far. Just being part of, whatever that means, should be enough. And what they really mean is they don't actually want the government challenged. They actually think that the government saying they think somebody is a threat really ought to be enough because they've bought into the whole threat of terrorism issue. And again, that's why the Taliban-Al-Qaeda thing is so important, Peter, because the majority of people at Guantanamo who are accused of any involvement in anything are accused of being foot soldiers with the Taliban in a military conflict in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
not part of Al-Qaeda, the international terrorist organization, people who are just waiting to, you know, get into the cockpit of a 747. It's not the same thing. The fundamental confusion at the heart of the war on terrorism, of this whole thing, is that everybody that they captured is a terrorist. Well, very, very few people are accused of terrorism. But when you claim that soldiers are terrorists, and you blur the distinctions that way, and not only has the public done that and the media done that, but this is what the courts have done as well, it's a huge problem. But the circuit court has been taking that approach that, you know, this is such a perilous area that the government shouldn't really have these, you know, these dangerous judges in the lower court be able to challenge what they allege to the extent that they've been doing. And so they've been undermining it. And really, it's ended up with them making the ultimate decisions about the Guantanamo prisoners. And since they got involved, nobody's being released. Every appeal the government makes has been granted. Everything is ground to a halt. And it really doesn't take much objectivity to stand back from it and see that this really, honestly, is not fair. You know, that this is a biased situation. And the Supreme Court won't hear any challenges. That's what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been happening persistently under Obama. And the question is, you know, is that simply because the retirement of Justice John Paul Stevens, who was the man who drove so much of the Supreme Court's opposition to Guantanamo?
And Andy, you made an important point in this article that was news to me, and I do try to follow these things. And that is the newest appointment to the Supreme Court, Obama's appointee, Elena Kagan, former Solicitor General, who presumably had some role in the administration's positions and even specifically in writs related to Guantanamo inmates, that she did not recuse herself in the internal discussions where the court made the decision to decline to review this appeal coming from the D.C. Appeals Court.
Well, yeah, in a couple of them. I mean, she has in some, she hasn't in others. I think what people thought was that her involvement as the Solicitor General was such that she would recuse herself from everything. And the problem that left, given the traditional, you know, left-right split of the Supreme Court, is that the court splits 4-4, there's no majority. Therefore, there's no chance of any change taking place. But no, it turns out that in these recent votes, and what happened is that the Supreme Court refused to consider three appeals by prisoners and also turned down three appeals by prisoners and refused to look at the case of the Uyghurs, the Chinese Muslims that we mentioned right at the start of this habeas process.
Right.
And that, yes, she actually was involved in some of those negotiations. So, you know, so it isn't true to say that she's going to recuse herself from everything. So that would seem to indicate that there's an unwillingness within the Supreme Court of anyone to take a position of leadership akin to that which was, you know, which is the territory of Justice John Paul Stevens. And I think it's a sad commentary, to be honest, on the politicization, in a way, of appointees to the Supreme Court that we can see just under Obama. But that, you know, we would probably see if we opened the window slightly larger and looked back over the last few administrations that have been responsible for feeding into the Supreme Court. And, you know, what's interesting about Justice John Paul Stevens is how he wasn't partisan in that way. How this was a man who had, you know, an extremely broad view of history, you know, having lived through the 20s, 30s, you know, grown up throughout this huge sweep of history. And his adherence, his interest was in the law. His interest was in trying to see the law through precedents rather than being swayed in any kind of political way. You know, and I don't mean to suggest that everybody is politically motivated in the same way. I mean, I think there are certainly people in the Supreme Court who's, you know, who are equivalent to card-carrying members of one party or another, mm-hmm. when they should be card-carrying members of the law. but, you know, I think it's more difficult. I think it's easier for some of the younger people to be swayed by their political affiliations rather than purely looking at what the law should be.
Mm-hmm. Andy, I want to quote from your article, and in turn you're quoting from a pretty strong editorial in the New York Times, and it names Judge Randolph, who you mentioned a few minutes ago. And the Times editorial says that the D.C. Circuit Court has dramatically restricted the Boumediene ruling. In its hands, habeas is no longer a remedy for the problem the Boumediene majority called arbitrary and unlawful restraint. The editorial continued, Judge Randolph wrote the opinion for the District of Columbia Circuit that the Supreme Court overturned in Boumediene. In a speech called The Guantanamo Mess last fall, Judge Randolph said that the justices were wrong to do so and all but expressed contempt for the holding. As the basis for the speech's title, he compared the justices who reached it to characters in The Great Gatsby. They were careless people, he read. They smashed things up and let other people clean up the mess they had made. And the editorial continues, in the Uyghurs case and related matters, however, it is Judge Randolph and others on the District of Columbia Circuit who are making the mess. Respected lawyers say they are subverting the Supreme Court and American justice. Of 140 challenging their detentions in the face of this hostility, dozens who should have been freed will likely remain in prison. Now, that is the strongest statement that I've seen in an American publication. Sure. And I commend the sometimes stodgy and often misguided editors of the New York Times for the clarity and the force of this statement. But it kind of stops there. They've said it, and the courts will continue on their path. And Andy, this occurred to me as you were speaking a few minutes ago, and I'd like to get your reaction here. Under Bush, we had very aggressive members of the administration, David Addington in the vice president's office, Cheney himself, Rumsfeld, others, including Jim Haynes, the counsel at the Pentagon, now working for Chevron. They were very aggressive in asserting the expansion of presidential power and were only reined in by the Razul and Boumediene decisions of the Roberts Supreme Court. And I'm sure it came as a surprise after the Supreme Court put Bush in office that they would turn around and limit his authority in these areas. But to its credit, the Supreme Court did so.
Yeah.
Now we have a case where Obama is not overtly aggressive on these issues, but he is not dialing back the expansion of presidential authority in any way. And now the courts are pressing the administration to move in a more extra-constitutional direction. That's my view. How do you see that shifting dynamic?
Well, you know, it kind of amazes me in a way, because I don't think in a lot of ways Obama is particularly driving for that. You know, I think that what it seems to show is we were in a very unique position. I mean, just in terms of national security, I mean, I think, you know, we were in such an odd position on so many different fronts. When the terrible Bush administration came to an end, and in comes President Obama, you know, even without the burden of hope and change, this was going to be a colossal task. On national security issues, you know, encompassing Guantanamo, encompassing detention problems, I would say, you know, it should be tied in with issues of America at war, and, you know, and how that's continuing, and the different fronts in which that have opened up on that. You know, he hasn't particularly wanted, you know, he did make a point of not wanting to rely on executive power in the way that President Bush did. He has made a point from the beginning of working with Congress. A lot of the troubles that he's run into on closing Guantanamo have been the result of working closely with Congress. You know, now he may not have stood up to them, but they've certainly, you know, betrayed him in so many ways. If you want to get things done, maybe working with Congress on these issues was not the best way forward, Mr. President. So, you know, those have forced him into different positions that into what looks like defending things that may not have been had he been able to get Congress to cooperate with him. But he simply failed to do that from the beginning. So I'm not sure exactly how it's panned out. What I think, you know, niggles away at me at the bottom of this that I find, you know, particularly troublesome is that he has fundamentally given a free ride to the Bush administration. He has fundamentally allowed a lot of the supporters of how the Bush administration behaved an excuse. And he's done that not by his demonstrable weakness on Guantanamo, but on his refusal and the refusal of anybody in the administration to seek to hold anyone in the Bush administration accountable for breaking the law.
Mm-hmm. He's also left a whole raft of Bush appointees, including U.S. attorneys, all across the country in office.
Right,
when
absolutely.
The tradition is that a new president comes in and all those people are swept out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have no understanding of why that is. I mean, but, you know, why did he keep Robert Gates in mm-hmm. position? And it seemed to me that he did because Obama and his whole team didn't have anyone to replace him. I mean, from the beginning, they were up against an aggressive Pentagon that was essentially saying to them, you know, don't think about messing with us too much.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, he hasn't taken on the torture issue. And to be honest, I can see why.
I'm sure his pollsters tell him it's kryptonite. You're not going to get anything out of it. There aren't any Guantanamo voters out there in the United States. And so give it a rest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. That's been the issue on Guantanamo. And, you know, and I'm sure that's the same thing on torture. The problem is that I think the torture underpins the Guantanamo story, and allowing it to go unchallenged has really poisoned something fundamental in America. And that is a kind of a creeping horror that he can't fight, even if he wanted to. You know, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I do believe the man has been extremely weak, and that it seems very hard for me to see that he really does genuinely believe in things that he would fight for. But there is a poison in America that is a creeping poison that is not getting any less. It's only getting worse. And it's the poison that is allowed to spread when you have had a previous president and a vice president who aggressively pursued the use of torture.
Mm-hmm.
And have got away with it, have not been called for it.
And that was a conscious decision on Obama's part, and as you know, Andy, I regard it as tantamount to obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
And it is politically suicidal, and we're seeing the diminishing returns already from that failure. And I'm sorry to predict that it will probably only fester and get worse. Andy, next I want to turn to a series of articles that you posted at your site, and you loosely dubbed it Bagram Week. But I think it's very important because, again, Bagram is off the radar screen of the American media, and I have talked about it many times in addition to your commentary. There's a great independent reporter named Anand Gopal who wrote for Tom Dispatch and for The Nation magazine over a year ago about night raids and black sites in Afghanistan.
Sure,
You now enumerate that there are as many as two dozen, but probably somewhere in the range of 20 at minimum, of these locations where people who are taken into custody are held. They're subjected to sleep deprivation and some other harsh techniques, including denial of clothing, it seems, and some, you know, angry exchanges, disrespect to the Quran. Recently, we haven't heard any explicit charges of torture, but feel free to contradict me if you know otherwise. What we're seeing, though, is that Bagram has become a kind of off-the-record Guantanamo. And they rebuilt, there's a new facility there, and they even renamed it to try to, I guess, confuse Americans that, oh, we've got a prison camp and it's not a Bagram, it must be okay.
So like the renaming of other toxic sites, which is generally nuclear facilities.
Right, yeah, yeah. So give us a sketch here of the current status of detention without charge of individuals by the United States in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's a great introduction there, Peter, and, you know, and it comes out of, you know, I've been following these stories as well. I mean, I try every 6 months, if nothing's happened, to make sure that I go back to it. So Anand Gopal's story was very important about the secret kind of, you know, frontline prisons, essentially the forward operating bases, and the, you know, and I'd heard about that from another source as well. You know, whether they could be, should technically be described as secret prisons, you know, I think that's probably a good way of drawing in readers. What they are is a sign of, is there a frontline sign of how everything has shifted since the war on terror began, which is clearly the military and the intelligence services got used to softening people up, which involved using techniques which are torture techniques. So, you know, to be honest, sleep deprivation and you know, the prolonged isolation, the use of nudity, religious abuse, it's all the same package that is actually torture, Peter. We could quibble. We may find out that certain experts would say, well, no, it's more just inhumane treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, it's wrong. you know, it's either torture or abuse. We can, you know, there are lines that can be drawn arbitrarily, it seems, at various points to define quite how badly you're treating people. Well, you're not supposed to be treating people like that at all.
Right.
So, you know, that's something that seems wrong to me, and it seems emblematic of the failure to thoroughly repudiate, yet again, to thoroughly repudiate what happened under Bush, which is that Donald Rumsfeld rewrote how the U.S. military behaved. So he threw out the Geneva Conventions, and he replaced it with, well, something like this, where you soften people up for interrogation. Now, you know, I am absolutely clear that from the terrible early days of Bagram to how Bagram is now, the Parwan detention facility as it is now, named after the province, that things have improved generally for the majority of people held, that this kind of casual abuse that I'm sure we've all seen and heard so much of in the early days of the war on terror is not exactly how it is now. I suspect that for anybody who doesn't really behave, and that may be 10% of the people that are held, whatever, they are then kicked about and they're held in isolation. We know they're held in isolation, that they are treated badly, that I'm sure that, you know, religious abuse and racism is rife still. I'm sure all this stuff is happening, but it's not in general happening across the board. But, you know, so we might say that the stories coming out of Parwan are that we, you know, that there was a successful attempt at quite high up in the military to recognize that a generally abusive regime wasn't very helpful, a especially when the way that prisoners were being captured meant that quite a large number of innocent people were held alongside people for whom there was any reason to hold. But that's part of the problem. The entire way in which people are rounded up hasn't fundamentally changed. So, you know, the Americans get attacked and they go out and they round everyone up. When the Americans are seeking intelligence, then they receive a tip-off from somebody who may or may not be trustworthy, and then they go out and they round up everybody, all the men. And they're rounding them up, and then they're taking them to Bagram, as they did at Guantanamo, frankly. Nothing has changed. And then they're sitting there trying to work out who they've got and why they've got them. And, you know, none of this is in the Geneva Conventions. Absolutely none of this is in the Geneva Conventions. You get it right when you capture people. And if you have doubts about people, you hold Article 5 battlefield tribunals. Competent tribunals, they're called. The Americans were pioneers of these. You convene them close to time and place of capture. You say, you allow people to call witnesses. They say, this man said he had a cart. We don't remember him having a cart. Yes, he's a farmer. Prove it. Here's the witnesses. You know, these were the ones that were used in the first Gulf War. Nearly 1,200 cases, and in three-quarters of those, the people were sent home. They were caught by mistake. It's the fog of war. Well, you know, that was done away with at the start of the War on Terror. And what's happening in Bagram, in Afghanistan, the way people are being detained, is still the same. It's really, you know, round them up first, ask questions later. And the questions are being asked sometime down the line. Now, it seems to me that they're improving the amount of time in general that they're holding people and have been doing recently, that it's coming down from a year and a half, used to be nearly the average, a year and a half, before they got round to giving somebody a review process. But, you know, it's still taking some time, and in some cases it's taking a long time, before these people get a review process that's not in the Geneva Convention. A review process that looks exactly like the review process at Guantanamo in 2004 and 2005, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, that the Supreme Court, in that case Boumediene that we've been talking about, found inadequate. That's the review process that is, according to the Obama administration, adequate in Afghanistan to judge whether they've got the right people or not. And it gets messy when you look at what they're deciding in these review boards of these three officers reviewing the cases. They're deciding whether to release the guy. They're deciding whether to carry on holding him at Bagram, Parwan. They're deciding whether he should be handed over to the Afghans to be rehabilitated, or whether he should be handed over to the Afghans to be held, or whether he should be handed over to the Afghans to be charged. There's a whole different load of options of what you can do with somebody. Again, where this has all been dreamt up. This has all been unilaterally rewritten. The Geneva Conventions, as interpreted by President Obama, as interpreted by President Bush, ongoing. What has this got to do with anything that anybody understands about how things take place in wartime? It's completely new. It has no basis. It's not recognized internationally. And yet it's happening. Nobody's talking about it. The only thing that you will ever encounter is that, you know, coalition forces in Afghanistan have always had a problem knowing what to do when they captured prisoners because they didn't have their own Geneva Conventions prisoner of war camps. And they've always been obliged to choose the lesser of two evils, which is handing prisoners over either to the Americans or to the Afghans. Mm-hmm. You know, now, at the worst of Bush's excesses, that was a real nightmare decision. It may have become easier. It may be that the Americans are more trustworthy and that maybe the Afghans are. But whatever it is, it's all been invented. It has no legitimacy. You know, and I was looking through the analyses of you know, the government was obliged to make available some information to the ACLU about these review boards in Bagram. So I've been starting a process of going through them. There are about 60 of them where they've made a certain amount of information available where you can see what the case was, what the claims are made by the government, what the counterclaims are that are made by the detainees, and the decisions that are made about them. And sadly, it's the same. It's the same kind of stuff that I'm used to seeing from the Guantanamo document, as the basis of why people are being held. I mean, you know, I was looking at a case recently where the board narrowly agreed that the guy that they had, they shouldn't carry on holding, because they had for a while been thinking that it was he was a supporter of the Taliban because he didn't stop them when they robbed his shop. Yeah.
That's just clear collusion. You can see it on the face of it. Now, Andy, one of the things that you report here is that the Associated Press has given us some numbers on the population at Bagram/Parwan, and there remain two facilities there, the Tor Jail or Black Jail, and this new facility that was recently constructed. And AP is reporting, I'm scrolling down here, that there are a couple of thousand, 1,900 prisoners currently held at Parwan, only 1,300 of a total of 6,600 suspects arrested across Afghanistan ended up at Parwan. So we just do the math, that's 4,700 people who are being held someplace besides the sprawling Bagram complex.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine they're all in Afghan custody, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
A bunch of, I would imagine not particularly adequate jails all around the country. You know,
right.
If you think about all the major population centers. I haven't had the opportunity to examine further those figures. I mean, they are interesting, aren't they? But that was my presumption.
Well, and hasn't it been that the International Red Cross has been unable to get cooperation to visit the inmates at these facilities, even in order to provide a head count and a list of who they are and where they're from?
Are you talking about the forward operating bases?
No, I'm referring to the Bagram holding facilities, Parwan and the old one.
I think they are allowed access to Parwan, actually.
Okay.
The problem is that, you know, who's being held off the books.
Okay.
I think that's always been the problem.
And what about the issue of people who were not captured in Afghanistan who are being held in one of these facilities in Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an ongoing, an ongoing problem. And again, another issue where President Obama did nothing to differentiate his position from the one taken by the Bush administration. There have, for many years, I mean, since 2002, actually, been prisoners at Bagram who were seized in other countries, rendered to Bagram from these other countries, and held, either in, a secret facility that existed there that was run by the CIA for some time, which I think was very much the story. They all were held in a variety of secret prisons run by the CIA in the Bush years. Gradually, that whole system, I think, was closed down, and people just ended up in Bagram. So they've been there, they've been in detention pretty surreptitiously since 2002. They've been in Bagram now for quite some time. They are not allowed to have access to outside lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And lawyers filed habeas corpus claims on their behalf on the basis that there was effectively no difference between them and foreign prisoners in Guantanamo. Now, this was not a question. I mean, they actually did ask the judge, they put in an Afghan case, and the judge said, look, I'm not dealing with Afghan cases because this is Afghanistan and there's a war on. My issue is with foreigners kidnapped and rendered to Bagram,
right,
whose situation is the same as the Guantanamo prisoners. He said, yes, it is. I can see no reason why it's not the same. Therefore, the rights that were extended in Boumediene should extend to these prisoners in Bagram. And, he was absolutely right, Peter. What on earth could there be a reason for him not to be right?
Yeah.
An administrative error might be all that stopped them being sent to Guantanamo, where they would have had habeas rights. Or at the time that they weren't sent to Guantanamo, it was because somebody was sitting there for some reason going, no, we want to keep these guys here. Maybe it was to do with different interrogators, or different information that they were after. It's absolutely clear that they could very easily have ended up in Guantanamo, all of these men. They really, really could.
Yeah.
So I think he was absolutely right, but Obama appealed it, and won.
Yep. Andy, one other little story for you. In my travels a couple of months ago, I was introduced to the friend of a friend who is he's an Army Reserve general who commands a group of the Corps of Engineers. And he was talking about how he was about to be sent over to Afghanistan on his third tour. And so just making small talk, and it turns out that he oversaw the construction of this new facility, which has been dubbed the Parwan prison facility. And he was surprised that somebody like me was going to ask any real questions about it.
Right.
So I asked him, how many people does it hold? And here's the guy who says he built it and he couldn't tell me, even in a ballpark range.
Okay.
And then I said, are prisoners being held there who were captured from outside Afghanistan? He said, oh, I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about how it operates. I just built the building.
Right.
So it was interesting. I didn't really come away with any hard news or actionable intelligence, but just his posture intrigued me, because clearly he'd never been asked questions like that before by an American civilian.
Right, right.
And I don't think it happens very often, and I'm sad that Americans are so incurious about what is being done in our names. Andy, just to summarize, could you give us a couple of other key points from your Bagram week, and we'll direct people to your website to read up on it?
It's these stories that really get me, really, I think, is the lack of intelligence, really, you know, and I think it's lazy. I think that what was encouraged after 9/11 was a kind of, you know, round them up and sort it out afterwards mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the problem with that is that it should be immediately obvious to anybody who has anything other than a colonial or racist mentality, you know, to anybody who has an understanding of these people that this is happening to as human beings with which we might identify. You know, that's why I exclude colonialists and racists, because they think they're inferior. They won't have any understanding of, they won't have any empathy.
Mm-hmm.
If you have empathy, Peter, you know, and I know that you do, and I know that many of your listeners do, how on earth has it ever been conceivable in what's nearly 10 years now of this nonsense that rounding people up randomly in vast numbers and then, you know, at some point down the line trying to work out whether you know, got the right people or not, is going to win hearts and minds? These are all people's husbands, brothers, fathers, sons. They disappear. They disappear from countries where their disappearance might plunge that family into financial chaos. But even if it doesn't, it removes significant people from the family for no apparent reason. And obviously, you know, on so many occasions for at least a year and a half, 2 years, if they get them back in that time. Maybe not more. Maybe five. Some of them are in Guantanamo. 10. Who knows? That's not going to win you anything. It's a lazy way of doing things. Now, it may make your military safer, but if your objective is to win anything that involves winning hearts and minds, then you're not going to win anything. So you may, you know, you may in the immediate short term not be losing as many troops because you're rounding up so many people who might be dangerous to you, but you're contributing to something that's going to go on and on forever and that you have no chance of winning. And I just think that's the position that we're in. And when I look at stories that are coming out of Bagram now, and some of these reviews that I was looking at are from June 2010, those are the most recent. That's pretty recent. And the same nonsense is going on where, you know, they don't really know why they've got somebody. And they construct something that looks like a story that may or may not be. You know, one of the reviews that I was looking at was two of the three board members. Two of them said, let's keep on detaining this guy. The third board member said, we haven't got a shred of evidence to support holding this man. Not a shred. Nothing. And yet two of the board members out of three said, he's a danger and we must carry on holding him. So they're carrying on holding him. Somebody's son, somebody's uncle, whatever. You know what I mean? It's just,
yep.
You know, it disheartens me, Peter, because I, you know, as you know, 5 years ago was the first time that I started coming across, well, I started researching it, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. But I devoted my life to this kind of stuff. 5 years ago, you know, and I went through so many stories, and I know, you know, I know prisoners, hells lie, and I know that sometimes these are people with not very good intentions at all who lied to their American captors. But, you know, more than that, I know that what I've uncovered over the years of researching this story is mistakes made by the Americans, and an arrogance and a refusal to acknowledge that mistakes have been made, and the wrong people captured, and people trying to tell their American captors that they've made mistakes, and nobody wanting to listen. And the same thing is happening, and the same ineptitude and arrogance is happening. And I just really wonder when it's all going to come to an end. So it's not just Bagram I'm looking at. It's this war in Afghanistan as well, Peter.
Well, and you know? you used the word advisably several times there, arrogance. And it really is the arrogance of the Americans who don't even observe our own criteria and our own constitutional rules. And if we simply operated in bounds, we would be healthier ourselves, and we would not be feeding the jihadi cycle.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I after what's been happening this year, Peter, in the Middle East, where you know we had those extraordinary sparks of uprising and those revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt. You know, I'm not sure. I hope they have a successful outcome because they only dislodged the leaders, and now they have to get rid of the rest of the apparatus. But what was so inspiring for me during those, watching those revolutions unfold, was the way that, hey, where are these crazy jihadist people? They weren't there at all. This was coming from ordinary people. It was coming from trade unionists. It was coming from intellectuals. It was coming from this mass of young people who were, you know, many of them connected to the internet, to Facebook, to Twitter. There was no worrying fundamentalist Islam issue going on here. There were certainly religious groups there, and they stayed in the background as these things were happening. They provided a certain amount of encouragement. Ever since, they have not shown any sign of coming forward and starting to saber-rattle. It seemed to me that what happened in the Middle East was the rehabilitation of the Arab people as ordinary human beings, that what happened in the Middle East absolutely destroyed the myth of this war on terror, that particularly what happened in Egypt, where the people who were toppled were the torturers who had worked hand-in-hand with the Americans to torture people, to explicitly torture people, where they produced false information through torture, where in Egypt they produced the false information that was used to justify the illegal invasion of Iraq through the torture of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi,
right.
That all of this was unraveled, that the people, when you remember when the young people in Egypt, broke into the state security headquarters,
and
saw that they've been shredding the files, saw the cells where people have been tortured. I thought this exposed the whole war on terror as a lie, and as a lie that's been going on for far too long now, and that a decade in, I thought it was time to sweep it all aside. And yet, you know, sadly, Peter, I have to say that when I look at the way that lawmakers in the United States who are driving this, the media that won't pick up on it enough, and the way that so many people have been taken in, the way that America seems to be living in a different place, a different time, a different world, where all of this stuff actually is still real and still counts, it's very disappointing to me. I thought that the myth of the war on terror should have been punctured by now, and that maybe in this new decade we could do something new. But there are very, very strong forces and very unpleasant forces that don't want that to happen. I think it's important for people to wake up and see what's happening.
Well, Andy, as always, I appreciate your work and your devotion to it, and I hope it hasn't taken over your life to the point where it ruins it, but you're really a great resource on this, and as I've pointed out many times, it's sad that there is no American equivalent of Andy Worthington. Before we wrap up, I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to tell us about what's going on in Britain, because here in the United States, we have this right-wing crackdown at both the state and federal level, where they're using these contrived budget crises to ram through rollbacks of social benefits that were achieved over decades, going all the way back to FDR's day. And you've got David Cameron and a new government there in Britain, which is dismantling many of the same social services, educational institutions, and government funding for critical services that citizens rely on.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because when you ran through your little introduction to what's happening now in the States, You know, now suddenly that there's been this budget crisis and Tea Party cranks seem to be in charge. Everything that you were saying sounded to me like what's been happening in the UK over the last few months, and that's not coincidental, obviously. You know, it is exactly what's been happening, and the rollbacks that are happening in Britain are being compared to taking Britain back to the 1920s or the 1930s. So, you know, it's very significant, and it's not, you know, it's clearly not accidental. These people are reading from each other's hymn sheets. We have been ambushed by, you know, by the most malignant right-wing policy that nobody voted for, frankly. I mean, what happened is that a minority of the public voted David Cameron's party into first place, but not with a majority. You know, they then had to come up with a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, who haven't been in power for decades.
Right.
Who, you know, capitulated to the demands of the coalition and have drifted as far to the right as possible, thereby creating the illusion of some kind of mandate. Now, the problem is that most of the things that they're pushing through, they didn't say they were going to do when they were campaigning.
Right.
The Liberal Democrats have kind of destroyed their credibility because they have broken election promises very explicitly. But, yeah, the whole of it is an attempt under the cover of the deficit that we have in this country that, you know, was very largely triggered by the financial crisis in 2008 and the resulting drop in revenue, increase in unemployment. You know, that's such a large part of it. Well, it's all been being blamed on the previous government as though they created it out of nowhere. We are not punishing the banking sector. We are not pursuing corporations who are involved in wholesale tax avoidance. We are not attempting to address the ways in which the banking sector operates to prevent them from creating the same kind of chaos again. And what we have instead is a government that constantly telling us that it was the last government's fault and that we all have to tighten our belts and that this is fair and it's happening to everybody, are exactly targeting, you know, the poor, the unemployed, the National Health Service, education, the fundamental building blocks of the British state, in some cases the building blocks of what we call the welfare state here, but the infrastructure of society, the infrastructure of essentially, I think, of a good society, of the stuff that has been built up over decades, most of the 20th century, in fact, that provided a framework for trying to look after the majority of the people. And, you know, and they're deliberately wading in there, smashing up as much of it as possible, which will lead to the impoverishment of a significant number of people at the bottom. It will increase the tipping of more people who were doing okay into that kind of unsalvageable, forgotten bottom part of society. And I think it's part of something that we can see happening across the Western world as a result of the financial crisis, as a result of the, I would say, frankly, unhinged right-wingers, and I have to say, sadly, you know, centre-left parties have all bought into riches and business as well. The rich must constantly be appeased. We have no stopping now the rich, whose only message is that the rich must be richer, the super rich must be super richer, everybody else can go to hell. These people are all now actively working to make poor people as poor as possible. Our government is actively making people unemployed. They claim that there is going to be some economic miracle that will create new jobs. What on earth that is supposed to be, they haven't even signaled. They can't explain it. It's disastrous. It is the single most disastrous thing politically that's happened in my life in Britain. And I lived through Margaret Thatcher's times, and I didn't like what she did. But she at least had a reason for doing what she did, which was to unleash those powers in the financial sector, which actually, you know, pretty much ruined the world economy a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she started a revolution in the way we thought and worked and operated that, you know, was taken up by Reagan, that defined the way that we've lived for the last few decades, and that I think burnt itself out when these thieves just about bankrupted the whole world economy. This lot that we've got in now have no vision. It's the same as the Tea Party in the United States. They have no vision for America. They only have a vision for how to take what little the poor have got and what little the working people have got and stuff it into the overstuffed pockets of the rich. That's it. There is no big plan. So that's what's happening here, you know?
And how much pushback is there? I guess about a month ago there was a big rally in London where 500,000 people showed up on a weekend.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's good, but, you know, there needed to be either that they should not have gone home again or that they were going to have another one the week after. There isn't anything on the cards. I mean, I think things will happen. I think the problem, and you know this is a problem in the United States as well, is that there are a large number of people who are essentially unmoved by politics. You know, there are people who just simply don't care about what's happening, so long as there's something to watch on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what these people are going to do when they find out that, you know, suddenly they've been laid off as well, because they're obviously not thinking it's going to happen to them. I think we have a problem, a decades-long problem, which is hard to address, that essentially a lot of our sense of social solidarity has been eroded. A lot of that was done deliberately. A lot of that came from people wanting to become more selfish consumers. We don't really know how to deal with the kind of threat that we've got now, that in our own countries we're not actually safe because there are forces that are saying it's not economically viable for us to live as we're doing. We're going to have to make more and more people unemployed. You know, people need to be asking why this is, and they also need to be looking at other people in solidarity. But I know what's happening here is that a lot of people have got their heads down, and they're thinking, so long as it's not me, I don't care.
Right.
You know, all this is happening, Peter. I mean, I think there is an awakening of anger. You know, I think what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, recently, and the numbers of people who turned up there was extraordinary. You know, and I think that, you know, that these impulses are going to keep coming back, but they need to solidify into something new. And I think for the first time in my life, genuinely, they need to solidify into something that is a political movement of the people, for the people, because that's what I mean by saying that finally we've reached the point where we don't have a viable political party in power, or likely to be in power, that cares about the interests of the people. They're now starting to think the pot isn't that big, and all of the guys at the top have got to get their share. So really, we're going to have to start bailing out on more and more of the people at the bottom.
Well, and it will lead us to fight each other instead of fighting the man, and that's what they want. Well,
right.
Andy, I need to wrap up here, but I want to thank you for filling us in on the situation in Britain. It is stunningly similar to what's going on here, and I'm sure that'll get my Bilderberg buddies going wild about world government. But I think that it happens with forces that don't require that kind of central control.
No, exactly.
All right, Andy. Well, keep up the good work. andyworthington.co.uk. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Peter, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
The United States of America tried a notorious terrorist in a federal court on American soil. He was acquitted and has been released. And after hearing Andy Worthington's update about Guantanamo, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the new detention center at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, perhaps my headline misled you a little bit. The story we're talking about now is the case of a notorious Cuban terrorist with a great deal of evidence arrayed against him, nonetheless acquitted in an American court in a jury trial last week in El Paso, Texas. Robert Perry returns to our program today, the investigative journalist who helped break the Iran-Contra story from which this episode springs back in the 1980s and has paid a price for it in some respects. He worked for Newsweek, he worked for the Associated Press and Frontline, and he now publishes at his own nonprofit news site, consortiumnews.com. Bob Perry, welcome back to the PBC show.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
And I've told you this before, and I hope I don't embarrass you, but I do regard the work you do as similar to what R.W. Apple, Johnny Apple, used to do for the New York Times, to write thoughtful packages that took a current news event and put it in appropriate historic context and also context with other current events. And you do that without Johnny's unlimited expense account.
And probably we write longer, too, I think, sometimes. Yeah, having the Internet, you don't really have to be quite as controlled by the inches you have in a newspaper.
Right. And the New York Times did cover the case of Luis Posada Carriles, but they really didn't offer any sharp comment on the remarkable chain of events that led to his release last week. We'll come back to the trial, more recent events, but I think it's important to help people understand who Posada is, what he did, and why it appears that a jury sympathized with the CIA in defending a man who was very clearly responsible for an attack on an airliner that killed 73 people back in 1976.
Well, Posada was trained by the Central Intelligence Agency, for one thing. He was a Cuban who lost out in the revolution in Cuba and became a dedicated right-wing opponent of Fidel Castro. He was involved in some of the Bay of Pigs operations and other things that went back to the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He later, as many of the Cuban exiles did, they were sort of farmed off to other intelligence services to work their dark magic in different places. For instance, some were used in tracking down Che Guevara in Bolivia years later. Posada ended up being a senior official in the Venezuelan intelligence service in the 1970s. And he was part of this this grouping that decided they would continue their war against Castro by pretty much any means necessary, that they would try to make anyone associated with Castro a target. And this led in 1976 to a plot to bomb a Cubana airliner. And this was really the first in-air bombing by terrorists. We've sort of seen this happen subsequently, but this was like a very original event.
Well, it's often, the Bojinka plot that is attributed to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is considered the first attempt by an Islamic terrorist to use an airliner as a weapon.
Right. In this case, so it was obviously meant to, it was a question whether they planned to bomb it on the ground or if the bomb went off later in the air. But nevertheless, The bomb went off in the air after the plane left a Caribbean island. It had taken on board was the youth fencing team for the Cubans, and it had won some award in a competition in Caracas. And then two co-conspirators got off the plane before it took off on its fateful leg, and it blew up. It killed these 73 people, everyone on board. The authorities pretty quickly tracked it to these two individuals who left. They implicated Posada and another Cuban terrorist, Orlando Bosch. Inside the CIA, we now know, based on documents that have been declassified since, that the agency also very quickly concluded who was behind it. They had some inside information relating to the movements and activities of Posada and Bosch, who were both in Venezuela at the time of this attack. Bosch fled the country. Eventually, Posada and Bosch were both arrested. It became, though, a political football in Venezuela because Posada had been working for the president, Andres Perez. And so there was initially kind of an acquittal in a military tribunal. Then he was brought up on civilian charges, and this dragged on. And once the Reagan presidency began in 1981, there was a real drop-off of interest by the United States in going after right-wing terrorists. And
Now, isn't that a little polite? Wouldn't it be fair to say that with former CIA Director George H.W. Bush as Reagan's vice president, that they build a cocoon of protection around these people?
Right. I was going to add that not beyond,
okay,
beyond not going after them, it became part of U.S. policy to supply them with weapons and to help organize them, and which happened, of course, in Central America, most notably around the Nicaraguan Contras, who operated as a terrorist organization against Nicaraguan villages near the border in particular.
You mean the freedom fighters?
Yeah, right. I guess what they always say is that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But in this case, it's pretty widely accepted by human rights experts that the Contras were terrorists. And in fact, there were senior officials of the Contra movement who acknowledged it. And we also now know that Reagan privately, President Reagan, who called them freedom fighters, privately referred to them as the Vandals. So I think we're kind of in agreement on who they were, but at the time it was considered quite politically dangerous to criticize the Contras if you were in Washington or to write anything negative about them.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being that the Reagan administration was very eager to support these extreme right-wing efforts, as Reagan had even as a private citizen supporting Argentina, for instance, in the junta that ran Argentina. After he became president, the junta from Argentina, that famous for their dirty war and the word disappearances, is a very dark way of getting rid of political opponents without acknowledging you've done it. They were actually invited to Washington. They were feted. They were, and many of their allies in Central America were given weapons. And the Argentines actually helped the United States in organizing the Contras back in the early 1980s. So you had this change of attitude, which essentially put the U.S. government on the side of the terrorists, and with the sense that this was the right thing to do because it was an effort to strike out at the communists and somehow to get the evil empire of the Soviet Union and weaken them through these proxy wars.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually the Posada case petered out. And he was helped in escaping by Cuban Americans from Miami, and he acknowledged some of that even in his own memoir. He then, after bribing the guards at this prison, he is then brought into the Contra program by the U.S. government covertly. Felix Rodriguez, another of these Cuban American operatives, had a key role in arming and supporting the Contras on behalf of the White House, working under then Vice President George H.W. Bush, whose National Security Advisor Donald Gregg was sort of the man in charge along with Ollie North, of sort of arranging a lot of this stuff.
And Gregg was a former CIA guy, and he was later the ambassador to Korea, I think.
Right, he had a stint as the ambassador to Korea, but he was a longtime CIA officer, mm-hmm. served in Vietnam and had been involved in some questionable behavior. But he had moved on to be this to the NSC and then to Vice President Bush's staff. So he was basically this known now fugitive terrorist Posada was handling the shipment of weapons to the Contras out of bases in El Salvador, and it was actually Posada, when one of the planes was shot down in October of 86, it was Posada who alerted Washington to this development and then was instructed to shut down the safe houses. And he was then on the lam for a while. Eventually, he even testified or gave a statement to the FBI at the U.S. Embassy in Honduras describing his role in all this. That was in the early 1990s. He was allowed to leave the embassy. There was really no effort by the U.S. government to catch him. He then was implicated in some other terrorist acts, including a string of bombings in Havana in the 1990s. He was implicated as well in a plan to bomb a speech in Panama where Fidel Castro was going to appear. So he had this history, and he eventually was released on that one, and he then snuck in to the United States, and he came in at a time when George W. Bush was president, and his brother Jeb Bush was the governor of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And when he snuck into Florida, there was no effort to to track him down, even though his whereabouts were pretty well known. Finally, he gave a news conference. At that point, there was sort of, the government was sort of, its hand was forced, but instead of doing anything to try or bring Posada to justice for his acts of terrorism, there was only a rather desultory kind of activity on the part of Bush's prosecutors relating to whether Posada had entered the country properly. And that case led to undisputed testimony at the trial from one of Posada's friends that if Posada were sent back to Venezuela, he'd be tortured, even though there was no evidence of that. The Bush lawyers did not contest it. So the judge said, well, you can't send him back to Venezuela, not that they really wanted to anyway. And he was allowed basically to go free and remain that way as a hero in Miami until Obama became president. And then there was this rather peculiar trial where Posada was charged with perjury, essentially, in several counts for lying to federal immigration authorities about some of his roles in these prior terrorist activities. But he wasn't ever charged on the terrorism. He was charged for not disclosing or not acknowledging certain activities that where he'd been implicated.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to this trial recently where the jury, and I'm not sure exactly why the jury felt this way. I wasn't able to do that reporting in El Paso, but they may very well have thought, why on earth is this guy being tried on these rather ticky-tacky charges if they really thought he was a terrorist? But he also, of course, his lawyers made the argument that here's a person who had fought the good fight against communism. He was a hero. He'd worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, and therefore the jury should let him go.
Well, I might expect that out of a jury in Miami, but El Paso seems far enough removed from the influence of the, you know, Cuban liberation political groups that I would hope that the jury would have evaluated this on a fair basis. They may have had pity on the guy because he's 83 years old, and they may consider the things that he lied about to be so deep in the past as to not be significant. Mm-hmm. But those are all kind of rationalizations, and of course we weren't in El Paso and can't really get into the mindset of the jury. Nonetheless, in your article, and I'm going to link to it in the show file at peterbcollins.com, you published on April 9th a pretty strong summary of the evidence arrayed about his involvement in the 1976 blow-up of the Cubana airliner. And with that episode alone, he, you know, clearly presents as a terrorist, and this suggests a significant double standard, that if you are a CIA asset who commits terrorist acts against a nation like Cuba, which, you know, we've had some policies of trying to freeze out for 50 years now, that even a jury will rationalize that behavior.
Right. I think that's a reasonable analysis that, as you said, we weren't in the jury room. We don't know exactly what the jurors were thinking. But I do think there's this sense of, well, that's, first of all, it's Cold War's over. A lot of things were done. And there's kind of a tendency, and I see this from people. When I write these stories, I'll get comments saying, "Oh, come on, Bob, that's ancient history now. Let's all forget it and move on to more immediate things." And that is a natural sort of human reaction, I suppose. But it is also one that I find troubling, because these sorts of acts, these kinds of acts of mass murder, these are war crimes of a sort. They are crimes against humanity. And that is certainly the position the United States has taken vis-a-vis the 9/11 conspirators, and even people who had very little to do with 9/11 itself, people on sort of the periphery in the Al-Qaeda or even outside of Al-Qaeda, have been very harshly treated by the United States. Some have been tortured and held without charge for a number of years now. So there is this sort of remarkable and troubling double standard as well that Americans like to sort of, at least the folks in Washington, like to beat their breasts about how tough they are and how pure they are regarding terrorism and how it's unacceptable in every shape or form. And indeed, groups like Hamas or Hezbollah are even though they have some legitimate roles too in those countries that they operate in, they're denounced and we have policies against them. But the United States then makes excuses for people that it was involved with who have done the identical or worse things than some of the people that we hold to account. So there's this endless set of double, triple standards, and it makes it very difficult, I think, to have any moral perspective on how we function in this world. And it's very difficult for journalists, too, because we are supposed to, what are the rules are, we're supposed to be objective and even-handed, and yet we're kind of supposed to sort of wink and nod when the pro-U.S. side is doing these things, but then be outraged and completely be beside ourselves when some enemy or some kind of adversary force is doing these things. So it creates a whole corruption, I think, to the democratic process.
Well, I agree, and it starts with the fungible definition of terrorist and terrorism. And, you know, we apply that label to the acts of people who are politically on another side or who disagree with a U.S. position. And the term terrorist has been, it's become very popular in recent years by any government that's cracking down on a liberation movement or any other activity or viewpoint. That contrasts or conflicts with the establishment view. And then it comes to, what is a terrorist act? Is it because innocent civilians are killed? Is it because these are non-state actors? An act of war taking out an airliner that is done with military authorization is okay, but when freelancers or others do this, then does that cross the line to terrorism? And so it really has created a real type of confusion, and journalists aren't the only ones who struggle with this. I think that average citizens, to the extent that they think about it, have a hard time distinguishing between a freedom fighter and a terrorist.
Well, I think that's all correct. I do think that, I've always argued that we should use a very strict and fairly narrow definition of terrorism, and I try to avoid the term as much as I can because it's fraught with all these biases and prejudices. But I do think that if you define terrorism fairly strictly as an attack on civilians to achieve a political point, then I think the word has some meaning. It should not be used if it's, say, an attack on a military force, for instance. I mean, that's why when I was at the Associated Press back in the 1980s, and there was an attack by Muslim forces in Beirut against U.S. Marines at the airport in Beirut. I think it was 241 American servicemen were killed in that attack.
That's right.
But it was not really an act of terrorism, in my view. I know I had this, and people were mad at me for saying that, but it was a case where the United States had intervened militarily in a civil war,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't just peacekeepers anymore. The USS New Jersey had fired on Muslim positions in the Bekaa Valley. So you had the U.S. fighting in a civil war, engaging in violence against what amounted to civilian targets in many cases, where some of these shells landed, and they struck back. So that should not be an act of terrorism. But it became how unpatriotic are you? It became like if an attack was against Americans, or if an attack was done by a suicide bomber or something, that became kind of this sort of floating definition of terrorism, and then it was excluded when it was done by a friend of the United States or by the United States. The word terrorism did get corrupted for political ends. Much as words like invasion have been corrupted, when the Saudis send their troops into Bahrain, that's a troop movement, or it's an intervention. Although I must say the Washington Post this week in their editorial actually called it an invasion, which was a real step for them. But you have this sort of, the use of language is important. It's not just technical. It's how people understand things and how they react to things. And George Orwell certainly understood, perhaps understood this best, but it's something we all know. And so when you allow the news organizations and the politicians to essentially politicize the language and use it selectively, depending on whether you're friend or foe or how they feel about you, then you allow for other acts to follow, often bloody ones, and ones that can even end up shaming the United States of America. So you have, so these things are not technical matters. These things should be fought on matters of principle, and that's why I tend to think, in a case like blowing up a Cubana airliner or a case like blowing up the Pan Am 103, that's an act of terrorism. And to fly planes into the Twin Towers is an act of terrorism. But I don't think that if, say, some Afghan kid attacks an American soldier he sees as an occupier in Afghanistan, that that's an act of terrorism. But it's sort of become almost defined that way. Any attack on an American anywhere, even a soldier, is defined as an act of terrorism. It's almost like saying, we hate this act.
And in that case, you're at least indirectly referring to Omar Khadr,
right. The
Canadian born who was a teenager when he was accused of assaulting and killing an American soldier in Afghanistan at a time when it was clearly a war zone. And I agree that the U.S. has tried to create a new category of law that didn't exist at the time the event occurred. Also, I would argue that our use of the unmanned drones over Pakistan amounts to a kind of state-sponsored terrorism because we're attacking suspects who we haven't been able to firmly identify and often based on information that comes from checkered sources, including the Pakistani intelligence agency. So it takes on many factors, but coming back to the Posada case and comparing it to the decision not to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a federal court on U.S. soil, I do understand some distinctions. Posada did not attack the United States. The accusations are limited to different events that he had some role in, but I don't know of any that were directly related to the United States. And it's fair to say, too, that his trial was over perjury and not over culpability for the actions themselves. But that said, this does send a very contradictory message about who we try for terrorism, where, and on what basis.
Right. President Bush was very fond of saying that anyone who harbors a terrorist is equally guilty as the terrorist. If you remember, it was a big thing. It was part of his Bush doctrine.
You're with us or against.
Right. And so, but here we have a case where not only did the United States harbor a known terrorist and let him live very nicely, thanks, but he was actually harbored personally by the Bush family. He was harbored in one sense by George H.W. Bush, who was both director of CIA and vice president when Posada was being allowed to move about freely with the U.S. knowledge. He was harbored by Jeb Bush as governor of Florida. He was harbored in a different way by President George W. Bush, who sort of made sure he never would be sent back to Venezuela, where he might have actually faced a real trial. So yes, I think yes, he did not attack the United States, but it should not again be a relevant point regarding terrorism. Terrorism should be seen as a problem against humanity, a global problem, if you will, and one in which every country, and this is not just how I think, it's how President George W. Bush said it, any country who is knows that someone in their midst is a terrorist has an obligation to act to bring that person to justice. And frankly, the United States said to not do that justifies invading that country, as happened in Afghanistan. And allegedly in Iraq, although that was just a made up thing. But so here you have this very strict policy, which is being flouted by U.S. officials, and by the same U.S. officials who set the policy up. So it becomes this. It's again this. What's happened to the United States? How we've allowed this hypocrisy to just pervade everything, and then we try to muscle people who. Or silence people who point it out to us. We get angry with whether it's foreigners or whether Americans, there's a certain anger about how dare you bring that up, how dare you, you must be an enemy, or are you somehow a Saddam Hussein sympathizer, or, you know, all these different things are thrown at people when they try to make this point.
And Bob, I'm going to read a couple of quotes here from a statement that was issued by a foreign government, and after I read it, I'll identify the government. The shameless verdict at El Paso is in full contradiction with the anti-terrorist policy that the U.S. government is said to profess, which has even led to military interventions against other nations, taking a toll of thousands of human lives. The U.S. government is absolutely aware of Posada Carril's involvement in the blowing up in midair of a Cubana de Aviación airliner off Barbados in 1976, the bombing spree against Cuban tourist facilities in 1997, and his plans to attempt against the life of Commander-in-Chief of Cuba in Panama in 2000, for which he was even convicted in that country. The U.S. government has all the evidence of crimes committed by Posada, many of which were presented in court at El Paso. We are still to see if the U.S. government is capable of either filing a new claim against Posada on a charge of terrorism or accepting his extradition to Venezuela. Now, it probably becomes clear in the language here that this was a release from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Cuba. And while, you know, I'm loath to give a lot of value to the regime there in Havana, I have long been a critic of America's policy, the failed policy of trying to isolate Cuba. And I have to say that their criticism of this decision is pretty fair.
Well, it seems very accurate. I mean, there's nothing in that statement that I think any objective observer would disagree with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at a time when we're trying to at least take some steps toward normalizing relations between Washington and Havana, this certainly doesn't help.
No, I think, you know, what happens often, though, in these cases is that every detail, every dotted I and crossed T of American jurisprudence works to the advantage of people who are sort of on the U.S. side in these kinds of issues. And the opposite goes for people who fall on the other side. Mm-hmm. So anything can be done to essentially lock up people if they're, say, suspected of being an Islamic terrorist. People have even been essentially framed. They've been lured into alleged plots that don't really exist but are sort of set up as sting operations. And these people get essentially no real mercy from the U.S. government. They're going after very aggressively people who have simply donated money to charities in the Middle East,
yeah,
that are alleged to have had some connection to terrorism. They're locked up and often given maximum sentences under, and everything is, the book is thrown at them. And in these cases, there's all this dancing around, and
a book deal is thrown at them.
Yeah, sort of. You get a special fundraising events in Miami on your behalf, and you're hailed as a hero. So this is quite unseemly, and frankly, if the U.S. press corps had not become this co-opted thing that it is today, these sorts of stories would be front page news.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be demands from not just from consortiumnews.com or the Peter B. Collins show that this be taken seriously. But this would be front page news in the New York Times and the Washington Post. They'd be outraged editorials and columns. None of that is what we have seen. None of that. And if the stories appear at all, they appear sort of buried deep in the newspapers. You know, a few paragraphs here, maybe a little scene setter there, but nothing that would match up to the crimes here and to the need for the United States to show that it is serious about these issues, not just using them for tactical reasons, but actually is serious about the crimes themselves.
And so has Posada been treated to a Welcome Back to Miami parade?
I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure. I've not followed it that closely, but he certainly was given celebratory treatment when he first arrived, and he's been... the guest of honor at fundraising dinners. I think he's also he's an amateur or somewhat of an amateur artist, and his work is purchased, and he's living quite a nice life in his golden years as a hero in the United States. And it's amazing also how outraged the U.S. is when we think about Islamic terrorists or people like Carlos the Jackal, who were harbored or allowed to retire in a sense in various places, whether Damascus or someplace in the Middle East. We think, oh, that's proof, that's evidence that country really is friendly to terrorists, aiding and abetting terrorists, even if the person is sort of in retirement and cashiered. Here you have a guy who has remained active, who is still calling for violent attacks, and was involved, as it was mentioned, there was this case in Panama, although he was pardoned on that by sort of this pro-U.S. Panamanian leader. He was convicted of being involved in this plot to blow up a school auditorium where Castro was planning to speak. So you have this guy who's not just somewhere in the distant past involved in acts of terrorism. He's remained as active as he could be.
Yeah. And where is Orlando Bosch today? Does he have like a America's Most Wanted TV show or something?
Well, I think that last I've heard, I mean, I've not checked on that recently, but the last I heard, he was also living down in Miami, and I'm sure he's quite old, and I'm not quite sure what his situation is. But I certainly haven't heard that he's passed away, and I think he's. But again, these are people who engaged in these acts to some degree with the encouragement and support of the United States, and in a sense that should make them even more important as examples that the United States government should make. That at this point the U.S. will not tolerate these kinds of things. If maybe in the past they were winked at, should no longer be the case, especially as the United States wages wars all around the globe against alleged terrorists.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for providing the history and the context here on what I think is a significant story and the disparate treatment of this Cuban terrorist and other terrorist suspects is something that I'd really like people to think about. Robert Perry, ConsortiumNews.com. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk with you. I hope we've given you some things to think about. Thanks for listening. Send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.